A couple tortured their French au pair and tried to pass her burning body. They set off as a sheep. That's not a rumor. That's what firefighters found and what a London jury heard. On Killer Jeans, who are Sabrina Kaudour and Kusim Madoni? Why did they fixate on a pop music figure from the 90s? And how did a shy 21-year-old named Sophie Leonet go from dreams of better English to a center of a delusion that ended in her murder? If this already sounds confusing and head-spinning, it's because it is. You're not alone. It's a diabolical case. Let's get into it. They want justice. They want answers.
What stands out to you about his personality?
What's the family want most of all?
Closure. But you were just the last person to see her.
Get
there's
out of my
an
yard
arrest warrant.
In Lee.
You have a lot of weighty accusations.
This is Killer Jeans, and I'm Melissa. Thank you for being here. Now, this is a story of toxic obsession, folie à deux, which is a French term for delusions and madness of two. And this case is about the systems and people who saw pieces of it, but not the whole scope until it was too late. Let's start off with the victim here. Sophie Leonet. She grew up in Troyes in northeastern France, a small city rhythm of neighbors who knew your name and the kind of quiet that makes even small kindness visible. Family describe her as gentle, reserved, someone who liked making people happy. She wasn't a headline person. She was a help in the kitchen, smile at the kids, learn the language, make a good life person. In January of 2016, she came to London, the way of so many French au pairs do, to improve her English, earn a modest wage, and live with a family while caring for their children. She landed in Southfields, a suburb not far from Wimbledon Park Road. The arrangement was with a couple, Sabrina Kaudour, a fashion industry hopeful with a magnetic surface and an unpredictable temper, and Kusim Madoni, older, quieter, a former banker and financial analyst who tended to present as the reasonable one. When Sophie was hired by the couple, she was quickly known in the neighborhood, but not loudly. She'd stop in for fish and chips. She'd say little, but a local restaurant owner, later remembered her body language first and then her tears second. Once she confided that she'd been hit by Sabrina for dropping butter. Now that sentence, it guts you because it's too simple to be untrue, right? There's no glamour in a bruise over butter. The isolation Sophie must have felt to confide in a local restaurant owner she barely knew. It's heartbreaking. Sophie would write home often because it was her only outlet. She wanted to leave. She told her family she was worried and she told them she needed her documents. And she was also so shy. That made it even worse, with basic English that made advocating for herself even harder in a house where the rules were changing by the day. Living with a woman who was known to have a volatile temper, her passport and phone, they would later go missing. Her pay, well, it became sporadic. Her world was quickly shrinking. Sophie trusted this family. She was vulnerable with the language barrier and lack of resources and community. This is the place in a story where we often start listening to the warning signs. But remember Sophie first as a person with a future, the kind of person who would have made small, good changes in 100 family photos with her love of being an au pair. The point of what follows is not to define her by the worst thing that happened to her. It's to understand what crushed all of those possibilities for her future. Now let's learn more about the couple who hired her. Sabrina and Osim, well, they met back in 2001. They dated on and off for years. Officially, they were attached by a religious marriage certificate at one point. Unofficially, entangled in ways that allowed Sabrina to describe him to others as a relative or friend while she dated elsewhere. Already this couple, well, that sounds insane with that arrangement. It's just bizarre. So why would you be romantically involved and then refer to him as your relative? The mindset there, the fast mental switch and disassociation, well, it's just creepy. Or was this more for her about money or opportunity or lifestyle? Their relationship was not equal. It was intense, controlling at times, and performative at others. She chased status and visibility. He often played the calm, managerial complement to her. In London, Sabrina worked angles in fashion and aesthetics. She could be charming, even disarming, but then volatile. Now, that is not editorializing. That is the consistent account of her neighbors, shopkeepers, and former partners. Now, Kusum, by contrast, came off pliable, deferential. Prosecutors would later describe him as suggestible, even. But put simply, he bent over towards anything she wanted to do. She wore the pants and controlled this older man she was with, then not even claiming to be with him. Living outside the societal norms, especially for a couple first attached by a religious marriage. Now entering into the picture, a guy named Mark Walton. You may remember the pop group Boyzone from 1993. I certainly don't, but some of you listening, you may. So Sabrina and Mark Walton had a two-year relationship that afforded her proximity to wealth, music, a world cachet, and crucially, a focal point for grievance after they split. When he met Sabrina in 2011, he was doing pretty well in the music industry, and she became obsessed with him, manufacturing harmful lies. Police records show Sabrina repeatedly accused Walton of some outlandish acts that ranged from the invasive to just the physically impossible. Imagine this. She claimed he was sexually abusive of a cat that she didn't even own, that helicopters were surveillancing her flat, from black magic and elaborate schemes to harm her family. She was cautioned over a fake Facebook profile, branding him a pedophile. I can only imagine the turmoil this man must have been going through, or the reputation hit that he took during this entire time. Now, the pattern was not one incident. It was dozens of contacts with authorities over years and years, escalating in intensity and also absurdity. This poor guy, can you imagine dating a woman and then all of a sudden they spawn into this level of craziness and fictitious lies, affecting your career, your reputation that you've worked so hard on? By 2017, Beatrice would diagnose Sabrina with depression and borderline personality disorder. The diagnosis doesn't excuse what she did, though. Is it a fact that helps explain the velocity of the paranoia and the rigidity with which she clung to it? Sure. But in that summer, her delusion locked onto a new object, away from Mark Walton, in a sense. So now that she's been officially diagnosed with a serious mental ailment, that's tough to navigate, right? So she would be open with everyone in her life because, well, it will affect those around her. So they need to know to help calm the storms that arise with this mental ailment. It's best to be honest about the situation so people can better understand what you're going through. Sabrina started to have new delusions. Here's the fantasy that Sabrina pushed and Kusum embraced. That Sophie was in league, in cahoots with Mark Walton, who she dated. That Walton somehow was entering the home to drug and sexually abuse people inside. That Sophie both facilitated and participated in it. That she was a spy, a traitor, even a pedophile herself. This wasn't a one-off accusation. It was a campaign, a fixation, metastasizing through the house. They stopped paying Sophie at one point. Then they confiscated her ID. They curtailed every move she made, and then they began the interrogations. The fault at this point, it's on this so-called husband of hers. He tolerated the delusions. He didn't try to get help for Sabrina, not for his wife or the au pair, who barely spoke English. He allowed this toxic cloud to hover inside the home, and that's where he is as a sane adult to blame. If Sabrina really suffered with such a severe mental ailment to her core, believing what she was saying out loud and acting upon, that's a painful way to live. And shame on him for not bringing in some help for Sabrina and for Sophie. But he went along with it. The couple went on to record Sophie continuously. Police would later recover all of these recordings, 8 hours worth. And those tapes and the still images taken from them are the closest thing that we have to a lab study of coerced confession under domestic terror, trauma, and torture. You hear Sabrina berating Sophie in French and English, sexualized insults, the language of a show trial. You hear Kusim playing the good cop, urging her to confess. You hear a young woman, barely audible, apologizing for things she didn't even do, sometimes denying, and sometimes simply just trying to survive the moment. Over weeks, Sophie becomes thinner, more withdrawn. She looks like someone trying to disappear from inside herself. And if she once confided in a restaurant owner that she was hit, I wish she could have ran, yelled for help, and confided in someone or used the little money that she got oftentimes to run and hide. So instead, she was scared into staying a tortured prisoner of this crazed couple. By mid-September of 2017, the campaign, it intensified. Sophie was struck with an electrical cable. The post-mortem would later document fractured ribs, a cracked sternum, and a broken jaw. Injuries inflicted in the days right before she died. In one of the final recordings, she appears emaciated and terrified, delivering a confession, quote, to fantasy crimes staged by her captors. The couple claimed they meant to hand these tapes over to police to expose Mark Walton, the musician, and Sophie, their cahoots. The judge later called that explanation what it truly was, a fiction, a distorted real-life horror story. Now, there's a clinical term for what happened to Sabrina and Osim together. Folie à deux, a shared psychosis, mental illness shared by two people. It doesn't mean they were crazy in a cinematic sense. It means they collaborated in a paranoid story that hardened into reality for them and became a justification for their cruelty. The story gave them a role. It gave them a villain. It gave them permission. And it also killed Sophie. Now let's break down the crime scene. On September 20th of 2017, Southfields, Southwest London, neighbors see thick, dark smoke from the garden of a $1.2 million townhouse. The smell is just wrong. It's chemical, organic, nauseating. Firefighters arrive. Thomas Hunt, one of the first on scene, steps into the garden and finds a bonfire belching heat. When the flames are finally beaten down, he sees clothing, jewelry, the shape of a nose and fingers. He asks flat out the homeowner, Osim, "Why are you burning a body?" Kusim tells him, "It's not a body, it's a sheep." The firefighter doesn't buy it. Police are called. The sheep is Sophie. Her remains are so badly burned, the precise mechanics of death aren't recoverable. But the injuries are there, and the story is there. And the tapes are there. A barbecue chicken sits nearby, a crude attempt to mask the smell of burning flesh. Did I tell you this was diabolical? Absolute next level horror. I can't even imagine this playing out in modern day as it did just 8 years ago. Sabrina returns home later in that day and is also arrested. In the hours and days that follow, they'll admit to burning the body, deny murder, and blame each other for the fatal assault. They'll claim they were gathering proof against Walton, this poor musician who never even knew Sophie. They never even met. The couple will claim they were terrified of him. The recordings, the neighbors, the community will soon all have a voice on this, a voice that Sophie never had. Now comes the trial, the folie à deux on full display. The Old Bailey trial, which London locals will get, it runs for 2 months and sounds like a plot from a bad thriller, except it's restrained by the cold choreography of evidence. The prosecution calls the pair a truly toxic combination. The defense leans on Cuter's mental health and Meduni's pliability. The jury listens to hours of audio where a 21-year-old is humiliated, beaten, and coerced. They see texts, notes, confessions Sophie wrote under pressure, and they would hear from people who interacted with the couple in the months before September. Mark Walton flies from Los Angeles, where the musician had been living, to testify. He has never even met Sophie. He denies every allegation. The fantastical and the obscene and the court accepts the allegations. They are fiction. The judge uses the exact phrases, complete fiction. During summing up, the prosecution argues motive as revenge and punishment wrapped in delusion and control. Now, this wasn't a sudden explosion of violence. It was a slow tightening of a noose, isolation, starvation, terror, torture, and finally death, followed by an attempted removal of her body by fire. The arrogance of standing eye to eye with police and fire officials, calmly stating the burning body was a sheep. The jury convicts both Sabrina and Usim of murder. The judge sentences them to life imprisonment with minimum terms of 30 years. On appeal, the couple challenged those minimums, also challenging the conviction, pointing to a jury note that says it showed uncertainty about their intent. But a panel of senior judges rejects the appeals, and the court promises fuller reasoning to follow and makes clear the result. The sentences stand. The conviction stands. What people saw and what they missed. Let's be honest about the geography of culpability here. Responsibility for Sophie's death rests on just two people, the people who tortured and killed her, period. But prevention and early detection are collective projects. In this case, too many shows small pieces of a pattern visible without anyone holding the whole pattern to figure it out. Stay with me here. Neighbors noticed smoke, which saved the case from becoming a disappearance. A shopkeeper noticed Sabrina's volatility and her obsession with the blonde man on her phone. A restaurant owner saw Sophie's tears and heard about the beating over butter. And he would often feed her because she always seemed starving. Local nannies clocked that Sophie didn't seem to be paid properly. And yet, none of those pieces alone screamed a murder is coming. They whispered harm, danger. And if you are in the world of domestic labor, au pairs, nannies, home health aides, you know the weirdness of the job. Well, it's part of it, right? You live where the boundary is supposed to be. You are both in a family and not of it. You are, by definition, dependent for housing, meals, and transport, but you need your passport, your pay, a phone, and sleep, and food, and the ability to step outside of the door, outside of that world. Remove any of those, and dependency turns into a vice. Sophie's English was limited. Her nature was shy, and she was very young. She was shy and young, one prosecutor said, and manipulated. She wrote home that she wanted out, and her mother even bought her a plane ticket. Investigators didn't find the ticket or the passport. Think about how fast a life can become trapped. A phone taken away for a day, a passport, your mail stolen from you. And then you wake up and realize every basic tool of escape is in someone else's drawer, in their control. This is where policy affects everyday lives. Agencies and host family platforms talk about safeguarding, but the mechanisms need teeth. Basic rules should be non-negotiable and checkable, right? Workers keep their passports, have independent phone access, have a written contract that spells out their pay and hours, and they have an independent contact outside of the family, someone that they can turn to for help if needed. Now, this isn't heavy bureaucracy. It's the minimum friction that prevents captivity from masquerading as employment. Fully ado, translating to madness of two people. It describes a shared delusional disorder in which one person's fixed false belief is adopted by another, usually someone close to them, someone isolated just like them. It involves dependency or power imbalance. Sabrina's delusional system centered on this musician, Mark Walton, as an omnipresent abuser with supernatural reach. Mundini accepted it, he reinforced it, and acted on it. That shared system rationalized their cruelty and framed Sophie as an enemy. Under that frame, every normal behavior became evidence. If Sophie was quiet, she was secretive. If she was frightened, she was guilty. If she asked to go home, it was because she was plotting and ready to expose them. It is crucial to say this clearly. Diagnosis doesn't erase agency. Let me repeat that. A diagnosis that Sabrina had doesn't erase agency. People with personality disorders or depression, they do not go around committing torture and murder. Most people with those diagnoses, they don't harm people. The court weighed Sabrina's mental health and mitigation, and they still called the behavior horrible cruelty. Shared delusion is an explanation for how two adults could remain in such this absurd fantasy. It is not a defense what they did. Now here's a legal sidebar. England and Wales criminalized controlling or coercive behavior in an intimate or family relationship back in 2015. So it targets a pattern of isolation, intimidation, monitoring, deprivation of basic needs, like what happened to Sophie. And then the Domestic Abuse Act of 2021 set the statutory framework for domestic abuse and crucially closed a gap by extending coercive control to abuse that continues after a relationship has ended. So after the conviction, Sophie's family, they spoke out in pain, in devastating grief, their language of grief. Her mother described going into shock when police came knocking at their door, and her father called what happened beyond comprehension and unforgivable. Those statements matter not because they advance a legal theory, but because they recenter the victim as a person with parents, a sister, and of course, a future. She was so young. The neighborhood, it felt it too. Southfields is the kind of place that sells you a newspaper and remembers your order. The idea that such violence could play out behind the garden fence next door forces really a reckoning with the limits of neighborliness. You can notice, you can ask, but you can't always see. The au pair community also felt it directly. Groups began talking in blunt terms about confiscated passports, unpaid wages, and house arrest. Would seem like house arrest dressed up as rules. Sophie's case became a shorthand for the worst case scenario. Tell a new arrival over tea to explain what to look out for and what to not stand for. There's also Mark Walton and what it means to be the target of a lie so large that it swallows a life. He showed up in court measured, consistent, and in the judge's words, with integrity. He had to fly across the world to say that he had never even met Sophie. Before we get to what the judge said to this couple at sentencing, first, how this happened and why it matters so much. Because if you diagram this case, it's a triangle, right? It was a driver, delusion and control. Context is domestic labor with structural dependency and the victim with limited power to exit. So remove any of those points and you probably wouldn't get to murder. So what do we do with that? For agencies and policymakers, mandatory in-person welfare checks to make sure that people don't have their personal possessions being taken from them, even hotlines that people have, au pairs can use in their own language, some safety net so this never happens to another au pair or nanny again. And of course, teaching people to spot it in communities by listening to the person who says that she's scared or hungry. Take the I dropped the butter seriously. It might be just an offhand line that you hear, or it might be a warning sign, a flare for help. So if you employ domestic workers on board with transparency and humility, for courts and culture, they should probably stop glamorizing delusions as romantic intensity. You know, jealousy, obsession, tracking exes, conspiracy talk about helicopters and hidden cameras. None of that is love. It's a storyboard for harm. And when you hear someone split the world into absolute villains and absolute loyalists, notice that is what's being asked of you next is likely not compassion. It's complicity. Now back to that sentencing day. The court sentenced Sabrina, 35 at the time, and Usiem, 40 years old, to life with a 30-year minimum. The judge called their behavior prolonged, pitiless torture and humiliation. He addressed them directly, saying, "You tortured Sophie in the bath, making her fear drowning to force information that didn't exist. There was nothing to confess because the plot was a fantasy." Very powerful words. Now, of course, appeals they followed, and the court rejected every single argument that they could possibly come up with. In court, a note from Sabrina was read, styled as an apology to Sophie and her family. It asked for peace and wished to turn back time. But for families, these letters are just salt, right, in the wounds. They acknowledged harm and erased it in the same paragraph. The court didn't sentence them on remorse, but rather on their conduct. She was 21 years old. She wanted to learn English. She was kind. She loved making people happy. And she was not streetwise or cynical. She probably believed that if she got through the day, the adults around her would wake up the next day and act like adults. She probably thought the worst thing that would happen in London was just homesickness. Her family will never get to see how that gentleness might have matured into something fierce and steady by 30 or 40 years old. And her sister will keep a place set at the table that now has a gap. Her mother will always remember the day police came knocking at her door. In this show, we try to tell stories with the dignity they deserve and the clarity that they need, right? Dignity is remembering Sophie as a person. Clarity is naming what killed her. A shared delusion adopted by two adults, weaponizing through coerced control and enacted as torture and murder. There were 8 hours of recordings because they wanted to prove a lie. There was a bonfire because they wanted to erase a truth, and neither worked. If you were working in someone's home and you feel control closing in on you, practice three steps. Keep your passport, keep your own phone with a lock code, an emergency contact outside of the house. Know the local numbers for non-emergency police and domestic abuse hotlines, and try to embrace a community and find friends that you can turn to when you need the help. It's of course not your responsibility, but it just gives you tools to help or even help someone else. Sophie Lyonnais should have been safe in the city that promised her language and work, and she wasn't. Society, I hope, can remember her better. And remember this so it doesn't happen to anyone else ever again. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Killer Jeans. I'm Melissa, your host. And if you learned something valuable from this episode, please feel free to share it with a friend.